Welcome back to the Live from the Podium series. Whether you're an entrepreneur or working in the corporate environment, the experiences that we face as women are often completely misunderstood. This episode features three groundbreaking experts who will not only share their personal stories, but also reveal key learnings for any woman navigating mental health, ageism, or fertility challenges.
We're so lucky to have each of you here tonight. You have incredible experience, expertise, insight, all of that good stuff. Let's start off by getting your personal stories and how the personal and the professional merged. So if I were to meet you for the first time and I said, Dr. Brown, tell me about yourself in 2 minutes. Take it away.
Well, I guess I would start by saying I'm a family doctor, and I still, after more than 35 years in practice, consider that an incredible privilege. I was lucky enough to get into medical school after an undergraduate degree in political science, but I felt I really wanted to have an impact on people, an impact on everyone's daily life. And getting into medical school, getting out of medical school, what for me was most important was the relationships. You know, in medical school, things are very interesting. You look at pathology, you look at different specialties, but what I loved about family practice, what I still love about family practice, is the privilege of sharing someone's life with them, their life choices, whether to have a baby or not have a baby, their successes, and often it's sadder things, the diseases that take their family, that affect them. So I guess I would say that I feel like I work with my friends every day, because at this stage, the people in my practice have become friends, have become people I care about very deeply. And it's different than looking at a job or looking at numbers when you feel you're taking care of your friends.
All right, Dr. Marjorie, how did your personal story lead you to Anova Fertility?
Okay, so I have to do it in 2 minutes. The story is that I was always passionate about science and biology. My dad was a reproductive biology teacher. He taught sex ed to the boys in a private boys' school in Montreal, and I went to a private girls' school, so whenever I'd meet a guy, I'd be like, anything you know, I knew first. But I had my high school library period, and it was Louise Brown, the first IVF baby's 10th birthday. And there was an article in Newsweek that was talking about the future of medicine, and I knew I wanted to be a doctor, but it said, you know, it's a marriage of science and procedures and evolution and genetics. And I went to my guidance counselor, and I said, her name was Tanya Gito, and I said, this is what I want to do, what I need to do. And she's like, well, Dixon, you need to be a doctor, and then I'll figure out the rest for you. So she went and figured it out and told me I had to do a residency and fellowship, whatever, and I was like, reproductive biology, it was my passion, it was my purpose, it was what I felt to be my mission in life. And then when I started working, I realized that women's health wasn't a priority for all physicians. And I bet that's similar to what you felt. I wanted to be able to revolutionize an industry and use my power and purpose and zeal for this to make a difference. And that's how it happened.
Christine, your book is called Too Busy to Be Happy. I'm guessing that came from a personal experience. Yes. Tell us how you came up with this guide.
Yes, so a little bit about me. I am a recovering engineer and and gone into management consulting. And the story behind the book, just in very short, was that I am very type A, very workaholic, worked incredibly hard. And when I got into consulting, I got promoted really quickly. And so as I got promoted more quickly, all of a sudden working more hours, longer hours, sacrificing myself and the things that I enjoy more and more and more, it kind of became a self-perpetuating cycle, because I would get promoted as I would work harder and as I would give up more of myself. And so eventually there was a moment where I started to develop breathing problems. I was on a really difficult project, and all of a sudden I was having shortness of breath. Went through, a battery of tests, and ultimately the doctor came back and said, you need to reduce your stress. which I didn't understand what that meant. And the doctor also said, I'm going to suggest Ativan, which I believed would be, kind of caving in. So I said, no, I'm not going to fill this prescription. I'm just going to keep powering through. And so there was a day where I actually remember waking up in a hotel room and trying to put my makeup on, and my eyes were welling up with tears because just the thought of another day of this vicious cycle that I had gotten myself into, it was imposter syndrome, it was negative self-talk, it was all happening. And I started getting into the habit of taking my mascara with me to work and putting it on in the car just as I got to my client's office. So this is how bad it got. And then the turning point was, or the moment where all of a sudden it had to change, I woke up one day and I was laying there and I thought, I need a break, and it can't just be a vacation. I need a real break. And I started to fantasize about getting cancer. So I actually had this moment where I thought to myself, if I could just get sick, if I could just take a real break. And the aha moment to me was that I wanted the people that I worked with that had those high expectations, plus myself, who had those high expectations, I wanted permission. And so I only tell that story because the reason I got inspired to write this book is that the first time I told that story about welling up in tears and laying there and fantasizing about getting so sick that I had no choice but to take a break and that everybody would give me permission and actually let me take that break with empathy instead of judgment, I've had people walk up to me with tears in their eyes and go, oh my God, that's me right now. And so with that, that happened to me a couple of times, and all of a sudden I'm like, I have to write this book.
Because people can't give themselves permission to take that break. They have to look for it from the outside, and that leads nicely.
I was just going to say, and you get punished for being competent.
Right.
You get more and more and more until you can't do as much as being given to you.
Right. And that leads into the next subject area I wanted to talk about with all of you, and I'll start with you on that, Vivian. Is her story similar to a story that you've heard before in your office? What do you hear from women?
Many times. When I talk to women, for example, and I'll use something very simple that we all hear from our doctors, you need to exercise more, right? Mm. It's important for your health. You heard from Meg, it's important for brain health, for heart health, for posture, for everything. You need to exercise. So what do people tell me? They say, I know, Dr. Brown, you told me that. I just don't have the time. And so I rephrase that and say, you have not made yourself the priority. It's not a priority. There's only so many hours in the day. But the understanding has to be just the way when you're on a flight and the flight attendant says, when the oxygen comes down, you put it on yourself first so you can put it on the child beside you or the family member beside you. If you're never the priority, you will pay the price. And so learning or getting permission to be the priority is part of what we talk about every day. It's not a matter of saying, yes, you need 10 minutes for yourself to get dressed in the morning without your kids in the bathroom with you. It really is the priority to give yourself permission to take the time to take care of yourself. Can I go on for one more minute? There's a very powerful movie called Lady Ganga. It's about a woman with cervical cancer who's told she has cervical cancer, and she goes back to India because she wants to teach women about how important it is to get a pap test and to take HPV vaccine. This is an area I'm very involved with. She unfortunately died of terminal cervical cancer. Well, I was at a conference in the summer, and her mother presented the movie, which is her daughter's legacy to the world about understanding how important it is. And after this, and the movie's on YouTube, you can see it for free. And after the presentation, I said to her mother that she's such a phenomenal parent to have been able to support her daughter in this terminal movie journey. And she said, I made her the appointment for her pap test, and she canceled it because she was too busy. And here's this woman berating herself for the rest of her life because her daughter never took the time. It's not her fault. You have to make yourself the priority, just the way Christine decided that she would be the priority.
Marjorie, in your practice, and you deal with fertility, 50% of those going through treatments feel concerned that it might affect their career. Tell us more about that and what people are saying to you in that connection.
So I think, you know, in the same vein that women keep calm and carry on, we have this need to be the ball. I call it be the ball, Danny. We have the need to be in charge. We have the need not to feel broken. We have the need to give this facade that everything is great. And fertility is one of those really disarming things. I find it particularly in my, I call high-end ladies. Professional women, women who are in charge of their careers, who pick partners that they actually like to spend time with, who go on and pursue goals that they enjoy. I had to say that out loud, but they've taken time. They didn't just marry or partner with the first schmuck they met. They actually took some time. So all of these things add time. And then when they get to this place where they're trying to conceive and it's not working, and they feel isolated and alone, and they don't feel that there's community around them, and there's no one to talk to. And then furthermore, the process is disarming, because you have to be monitored daily. You have to do an ultrasound and blood work, and you have to get the results back and act on it. You feel like you're at the mercy of your physiology, and it's not working. And I find that it's particularly disarming, and women can't give themselves the break of being okay with, I need somebody else's help to get me through this. I need to find my community through this. I need to seek support from the people around me. I'm not broken. This is my physiology. We need to educate each other about this so that people, this cannot happen to the next generation of women. Why aren't we talking about this sooner? Like, those are the kinds of things I find that, and then being a woman who's been through fertility treatments myself, I've had IVF 3 times, and I'm a physician and I educate, and I'm always talking about this no matter where I am. I can be at Cancun in a pool, or I can be down on the bus stop, or no matter where I go, I'm talking about fertility and the limitations of our reproductive lifespans and how it's not our fault, but we need to do a better job of educating women than advocating for ourselves and as entrepreneurs into our businesses, bringing it into our human resources departments and talking about benefits and how can we accommodate for women who are going for cycle monitoring in the mornings. Should there be in every workplace the accommodation for those mornings so everybody's entitled to, you know, 7 mornings out of the month if they do need to seek fertility treatment? It sounds like it's revolutionary, but it needs to happen. And unless we press for it, it's not going to change. And giving women the okay to say, I need this for me, and I don't just have to keep calm, carry on, and be the ball at work, and then be supportive of my family, and be caught in the sandwich generation, support my mom with dementia, and my kids who need me at school, because secondary infertility is just as disarming as primary infertility. So if you've had a baby but you're trying again, it's not working, it's just as devastated to people who have never had children. So those are the kinds of things that I get to see, and I feel the need to talk about so that I can make a change.
Mm-hmm. Christine, when it comes to talking about it and women feeling like they can't, what is your advice to them? What sort of stories do you hear that have that sort of universality that you can share with us and from your experience what you can offer them to help?
Yeah, I mean, just really quick, even when I was listening to the fertility conversation. So in my own experience, I just want to share this because this is so on point with what you said. I went through 6 pregnancies in order to create 2 humans. So I lived through that exact thing that you're talking about, where it was just a huge part of my energy outside of work in order to try to conceive a human, which was, you know, in my brain, I had the association that this was going to be easy, right? And that was, you know, not the case. But interestingly enough, I mean, I remember distinctly going through that kind of loss and not having the comfort to be able to talk about it in the workplace and not being able to talk about it with people that I was working with. And I so distinctly remember one situation where I was in the middle of that experience, and there was somebody, a gentleman with a cold, and everybody kept going, oh my God, you're cold. Oh, Dan, you should go home. You look miserable. And I was like, oh my God. Like, my brain wanted to just, you know, rip open. I'm like, because my heart was broken and I'm feeling terrible. And I'm thinking to myself, if one more person mentions Dan's cold, I'm going to lose my mind.
You know? Dan's going to have much more than a cold.
That's right. He's having a man cold. So, but I mean, I think so that my own experience, and then, you know, today I coach about 60 to 70 women as part of the Advancement Center work that I do. And I just see this happening all the time. So many women are going through this, and we have a stigma about being able to talk about it. So first of all, I see women who are terrified to tell their employers anything about the fact that they're going through fertility journeys to begin with. So I feel like, A, number one, we need to change this stat, and we just need to make it more common. We also do need to talk about miscarriage and IVF and, you know, what's going on for a client when they're going through an IVF cycle and they need cycle monitoring and all of these things. Like, we just need to make this more comfortable and normal, and we need to start to get leaders to be much more comfortable with the fact that this is part of inclusivity, people. Like, it's not just having women on the in the team, it's actually also honoring their entire life experience and still wanting them to be part of the organization. So I just wanted to bring that up because I think I see that every day in my clients' lives where they're struggling with fertility and they're scared to tell anybody about it.
Let's talk about ageism in the workplace. Is it really a thing?
Oh, yeah.
You want to join the panel?
Yeah. I think it is a real thing, and I think that there's issues for women whatever profession you're in. You know, it's been in the news recently, women surgeons doing the same work earn less than male surgeons. You know, there's a whole issue around the age of people and whether they're old enough or too old to be in a certain position. You know, we're looking at Joe Biden every night on the news, and all they talk about is how old he is. You know, they don't talk about his politics, they talk about his age. You know, and I think for women, it's really important to remember that you do have some power. And, you know, there's human rights legislation. You can choose to find a mentor in your own profession that you can get coaching from. But I don't think it's subtle discrimination. I think it is discrimination.
Christine, do you want to add to that? Do you hear about that sort of stigma about ageism, mm-hmm. women revealing their age, being too old, too young?
Yeah, and actually it's interesting that just this topic was really interesting to me because, again, coaching so many women, I do see a lot of women who do hit, like, you know, late 40s, early 50s that start to feel like they're subject to ageism. So I definitely see it. And I didn't really understand it, and I feel like I'm just getting close enough to it now where I'm like, oh yeah, there really is ageism. I'm seeing it firsthand. And it is interesting how it feels like a bit of a double standard because a lot of the times the coaching clients that I have might have stepped away from trying to get promoted while their children were young. And so now they're a little bit older, but their children are away at university, and they're like, I'm ready to lead, and I've been around here for 15 years, and I've got piles of experience and wisdom to add, and now I'm ready for that bigger commitment, and I want to lean in, and now people are telling me I'm too old.
Marjorie, people are demoted for taking a maternity leave?
Yeah, I mean,
and the most, before you get into this, I didn't know this. This is so crazy. Serena Williams, after she had her baby, was dropped in ranking from number one to number 451. If that is not a conversation starter, I don't know what is.
Yeah, absurdity. I often joke, and it's not nice, and it's not like I don't like men, but I say if men had paternity leaves and they gave birth and pushed babies out of their penises, there would be like reintegration programs and government subsidies and like maybe they'd even have a week off when they got their kids. Like, I, honest. And again, as we do this, we don't have, like, as an entrepreneur, even for myself. So I was growing a business. I quit one job, hired people. I was 7 months pregnant. I was ready to open my first little cycle monitoring center as a fertility specialist. And I moved on the 14th of January, gave birth on the 22nd, and was back to work on the 14th of February. Like, and I had no choice. It was my baby. I was growing it. And people say, like, how did you do it? How did you know what to do? I was like, oh, I had no choice. And I figured that it was okay to have help because I would still be able to love my kids. My business was my baby, and I wasn't going to feel guilty about it because I felt like I was in a place of privilege to be able to even do this. And so I had to let go of the guilt that I felt. But some people don't have that luxury, right? And when you're at the mercy of your employer, I mean, even an example, and she talks about it all the time, so one of my assistants, I have lots of them so you can't figure out who it is, but one of my assistants had fertility issues and had been in another clinic and says, you know, Dr. Dixon, I've been really struggling, broke down one day crying, and I said, I'll help you. And she's like, but you're my boss. I'm like, yeah, but this is my passion. Like, I want to make you babies so you can have as much grief as I have on a daily basis. And so I helped her. And she ended up having her baby and going for a year, and I survived. I had other people come in, and I'm like, if I'm going to talk about empowering women to make whatever choices they want for their family or not, I'm going to have to actually do in my office, do unto others, and show by example that I support women that are going on their mat leaves and reintegrating them back into it and keeping their jobs for them and appreciating them even after they've had their maternity. It's not like our brains go to mush and don't work, mm-hmm. right?
So the reality is there are consequences to being Absolutely. Open about whatever struggles we may have. I'd like to get each of you to share your advice on how to navigate that. How do you go through that? You want to be open. You care about your career, but you don't want that to be held against you. Christine, I'll start with you.
That's a good one because obviously, the piece around mental illness, which I truly believe, even though I find it still uncomfortable to admit, I really experienced mental illness. I think there's a couple of things that I see sometimes is that there's the stigma that's the outside world and the way that they're looking in, but there's the way that we see that stigma and the way we behave as a result. And I know for a fact that a lot of situations that I see, we're so embarrassed about whatever the stigma is, let's call it mental health. We're so embarrassed and so uncomfortable, and in that moment we feel like a failure, that we're making the stigma worse. So sometimes I'll challenge people like, hey, if you're gonna take a break, take a real break. Don't negotiate, don't just sliver out one more day, don't just sliver out one more week, but if you're gonna take a break to actually take care of yourself and recover, fully rest and recover. So take 2 months, take whatever it is that's actually going to allow you to be bored and hungry to go back to work again. Don't just take a long weekend and then next week you need to take another sick day and you're always apologizing for yourself. Like, I mean, I've seen that with clients where they apologize their way through it with sick days here and there, and really they're struggling so badly that they can't catch their breath. And my argument is, powerfully say, it has come time for me to prioritize myself. I am going to take 2 months off, and I need to own this right now. This is my biggest priority, is me and my health, and I need to own this. I'm not going to squander it on 72 sick days. I'm going to just own this. This is what I got to do. And when I come back, I'm going to be whole again. And you're going to have a powerful employee on your hands. And I think if we start to advocate for it that way instead of apologizing, I really think we'll see a shift.
Marjorie?
I think, particularly, I guess I have to come to it from the fertility place. And I see women struggle, and they are just, can I get unemployment? How do I get out of this? Should I take time off from my retrievals or transfers? And I'm like, what's right for you is right for you. And I will advocate for you. I'll write you a note for your work. We can fill out forms together. We have a department in the office that does that. But again, the keep calm, carry on, I bring it back all the time. I say we do that is when we shove it down. And we're like, I can manage this. I can get through this. And I'm like, if you're feeling that way, that means that you're not managing. And that we actually have in office psychologists and psychotherapists that are there for our patients to address these issues, that they can have access to, not just when it gets tough, but I say, you know, on the first visit, we're going to introduce you to our department that is part of our integrative wellness group that will be there as support so you can meet them and they're people that you're familiar with so that when you need access to them, you know them already. You don't just wait for them to be needed and then need to access them. It is okay for us to say we're not okay. I say I'm not okay all the time, but I think that it's difficult for high-end, I call it high-end, I don't know why I say that, but high-end women to admit vulnerability. And I think that when we admit our vulnerability, it empowers us because then we're being true to ourselves. And I do that as a CEO. Like, I have 3 kids. I have big business. People say, oh, my God, you're so great all the time. I'm like, actually, on the weekend, I got a babysitter and told them I was going to a hair appointment but went to see a movie all by myself. So, like, we have to be okay with having those moments to recharge our batteries because otherwise we can't get through this.
Yeah.
So I think one of the big issues for each of us as individuals is deciding what is a stress and what is a challenge. A challenge is great. We may be stressed about a given exam, or we may be challenged because we're applying for a new promotion or a new job. But there's a big difference between seeing something as a challenge that you're putting yourself forward to and your adrenaline's up and you're really working hard for this, or seeing something as a stress. And something that is a chronic stress ages you. And there's research that shows this. Are any of you familiar with the term telomeres? Telomeres are the caps on the ends of chromosomes, sort of like a rain cap and rain boots that protect your chromosome. And they divide over time, and you want your telomeres and you want telomerase, which is the enzyme, to live for a long time. Well, there's a woman named Elizabeth Blackburn, who's a doctor that got a Nobel Prize in 2008, 2009. What she did is she took two groups of women. One group had healthy children, and one group had chronically ill children. And she used those two groups as her model for chronic stress versus the norm. And what she was able to show is that people with chronic stress ended up having telomeres and telomerase that was 10 years older. But what was really important was not how sick the child was, it was her perception of stress. So your perception of how stressed you are, as opposed to what is the challenge that you're excited about in a new career, in a new position, in a different job situation. It's your perception of whether you're stressed or challenged. And so what I encourage women to do is to try and decide if they're challenged, and that's great, and your adrenaline goes up, but then it comes down, or if you're chronically stressed with your adrenaline up that never comes down, and leads to different changes and leads to early aging. And I think that's a really important distinction, because it doesn't mean every woman in a high-powered position needs to take off time. It's her perception of whether she's able to do what she's doing or whether she's finding it overwhelming and much too much and no longer satisfying.
I like the way you put that. That's a good question to ask ourselves. Is it stress or is it a challenge? Can that be reversed, by the way?
They're looking at that. So that's a really good question, Marcia. So it's not ready for prime time, but just the way you go to your doctor and you get your cholesterol measured, at some point, they're looking to see if you can get your telomeres measured and your telomerase measured. And what we need to work on and what's being done in lots of startups is looking at what are the norms. What are the norms at different ages? If they measure it and you measure out 5 years older than you should be, and then you go hard, you go work hard for 2 years exercising and taking care of yourself and doing everything right, and you remeasure it, can you expect it to be lower and be back where you should? So all of this research is going on right now. The doctor's name is Elizabeth Blackburn, and she's working on commercializing telomeres and telomerase so that we have a way of measuring how our body is reacting to stress.
Marjorie, you kind of touched on this. What do really good companies do for women in the workplace to help them get through whatever it may be, fertility, depression, burnout, loss of a spouse or a family member? What do those really good companies excel at?
I think that they excel at identifying women as people that matter in their companies. So we talk about women-centered initiatives in companies to talk about even their fertility. So I'm fertility. Their fertility portfolio in their health benefits, for example. Are the medications covered? Are they not? Do they cover the procedures sometimes? Because we know the province of Ontario will cover first cycle of IVF, but there's a wait list, etc. There are actually some employers that cover for IVF cycles. And one of the biggest barriers to access for women and families, and we're talking about women, but we're talking about anybody that's seeking to grow their family. So regardless of their, you know, sexual identity, orientation, gender, family status, single family, etc., the main barrier is finance, because it's an expensive venture. And then also there is the emotional toil of you're not going to see a doctor once for an appointment. You're going several times in a month, and then you go, you have your intervention, then you have to wait to see, do you get your period or not? And then your period comes, and a lot of women just feel, deflated. it brings you right back to I'm a failure. And then you have life going on all around, right? So for an employer to recognize that this can be disarming and to provide accommodations is a big deal. And so as an employer myself, I had to make sure the health benefits that we have actually cover fertility drugs. I had to make sure that there was a safe place in human resources for someone to say if they needed time away, not just for fertility, but for anything. Will I accommodate? Do they feel supported? Right? And even through our human resources initiatives available to all of our staff to know what it is that we do for them as initiatives around family building. So as an employer who has the ability to do that for my staff, I think it's important then to work with other employees and to say, you know, it's not just what you cover for that you have dental and eye care. Fertility care matters. And then also talking about fertility preservation, because so many women are busy building careers and are busy becoming entrepreneurs and putting things off. In the old days, we didn't have the ability to freeze eggs very well. It was an old technique. When we warmed them, we couldn't fertilize them very well. Now we have a process called vitrification, so we can actually freeze eggs and warm them and fertilize them quite well, which is different. So when you bank eggs now, you actually do have a bit of an insurance policy that you can rely on. And there are tests that we can do for women, and some of them cost money. They're not a lot of money, but there should be an initiative where we talk about, okay, so you do a fertility check between the ages of 25 to 30. We do a great job of talking about contraception. We don't do a good job about talking about conception planning. And I don't want to pressure people. If you don't want a baby, that's fine. You don't want a family, that's fine. But you need to understand that there are limitations there too, and you have to be tested early so that we can intervene well. Because if it's too late, I can't reverse, not yet. There's all kinds of research. I'm working at it. We have a research department. We're looking at how do we talk about genes. How can we reverse menopause? How can we stop the aging process within eggs? Eggs, the largest cell of the human body, only women have them. Men don't, just saying. But it also, it's the eggs. Our ovaries are egg storage units. Testicles are sperm production factories. So as men sit, live, breathe, walk down the street, get hit by a car, whatever, they are making sperm. We are not. We're born with a certain number of eggs in our mother's bellies. 4 months, 5 months of gestation, we max out. After that, it's all downhill. So we have to talk about how can we preserve that? Because as we are moving in to having careers that are big, and we're becoming entrepreneurs, and we have daughters, and we want to be able to prevent them from maybe experiencing what we experienced as infertility, are there measures that we can access that can help that? And those are the conversations we need to have. And then we need to be able to make a difference. So I bug everybody. I talk to government. I talk to corporate people. I talk to hospitals. I talk to the administration of hospitals. I talk to everybody who listen. But we have to change it, because what I despise is meeting women who didn't know. And then you are at the mercy of your biology. And we shouldn't be. We're highly educated, highly functioning, very wonderful, fantastical human beings. We know the difference. If we can make an intervention and make a difference to our future and empower ourselves and do that early, that's what we should be doing. And we have to talk about it, because people don't know. We all know. But, you know, outside of this room, you talk to a bunch of other women in another building, they wouldn't have had that conversation. So we have to make it equal opportunity for access.
Vivian, what are you seeing companies doing to help women, and what examples can they show for other companies that may be wondering?
So I think one interesting area that's starting to be more prominent in lots of different companies, and you heard that I work for Medisys, which is a company that does a lot of work around preventative health, is the whole idea of virtual care and giving people access to a doctor or a nurse or medical information virtually. And, you know, for women who may have children at home, and we talked about the sandwich generation and older parents, sometimes it's very hard to get to an appointment, and you may just want a quick answer to a question. I'm mistaking this medication. Do I take it twice? What do I do the next day? The whole idea of being able to access care virtually through your cell phone, get to speak to somebody, get a reasonable answer, not Dr. Google, not a generalized answer, but an answer for you, I think is really innovative. And so at Medisys, that's what we're working on. We're working on companies buying the option of virtual care for their entire company, so that there's less wasted time getting to a doctor's appointment, waiting in the waiting room, and then ultimately getting that question answered. And as we have an aging population, we have lots and lots of people living with their chronic disease. People survive their heart attack. They're surviving breast cancer. They're surviving, multiple issues with diabetes. So we've got people on 8, 9, 10, 12 drugs, it's often hard to keep track, and people make mistakes every single day. So having the ability to access something easily, I think, is particularly important for women who often have the burden of childcare. Right? They know what their kids are doing. They know what the issue is. Take a picture of that rash, send it in, and find out if your kid needs to be seen or no, this is just whatever it is, viral. It's going to get better.
Embrace the technology. Okay, Christine, your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about employers and what we're doing to actually help with some of these problems, I just want to introduce this really quick concept because Vivian talked about perception of stress. I'm going to circle back to that really quick because I think it's so important. And the entire concept of the book that I gave everybody tonight is the concept of emotional real estate. So if you think of all the thinking that you currently do, I always kind of say if your brain is the house, it's the front yard. Your emotional real estate is this fixed amount of front yard or patch of land that you have, and that is the space you have to process decision-making, thinking, procrastination, thinking about your fertility treatments, thinking about whether, you know, if you have 7 medications to take, you need emotional real estate to do all the processing, to remember all those things, to remember the new steps every time you're doing something, right? When you're at work and they introduce a new change, you're using heavy amounts of emotional real estate. So the whole idea is to actually become really conscious of the perception of stress. So how do I start to pay attention to the fact that I'm using up more emotional real estate than I actually have available? And I would argue that I treat emotional real estate as a variable just like time and just like money. So every time I'm making a decision, I'm balancing emotional real estate versus time versus money. So am I going to go through fertility treatments this month when I know I've got year end and I've also got, you know, I've got whatever, 1 sick kid already at home? I might actually make the decision that I don't have enough emotional real estate to manage this additional task this month, and I might, you know, move that to the next month when I think I have some more available. So one of the things that I'm seeing, this whole concept of emotional real estate has become really powerful because we're now starting to teach leaders this, and we're starting to teach women this. So a lot of women that I coach, this is actually part of the Advancement Center program, is how do we actually help people start to identify what is using up emotional real estate for them? What things do they have choice to let go of? What things do they need to take action on? And then how do they start to spot the things that give back a higher return on investment of their emotional real estate? So exercise, for example, gives back more emotional real estate than it takes. Ironically, it uses a lot of emotional real estate if you're procrastinating, you know. I always say it takes me 3 hours of emotional real estate. If I sit there and go, I should go, I shouldn't go. No, don't go. Just sit on the couch. Then, like 3 hours later, I've used more emotional real estate than if I had just gotten my butt off the couch and walked out the front door and went for a walk. So, but the whole idea is as we start teaching leaders about this, they can start to, A, become a little more aware. So I'm seeing, by the way, I had to package this for a male sales team as time management for the 21st century because if I called it work-life wisdom or emotional real estate, they would have been like, ew, ew, ew. But I packaged it as time management for the 21st century, and all of a sudden come to find out a lot of them also would like to get more emotional real estate back, and they would also like to recognize it in their employees. So even knowing, okay, you know, if somebody is going through fertility treatments this month, maybe I should be hyper aware of the fact that that person is using a lot of emotional real estate. It might not be a great time to dump a brand new process on her plate, or it might not be a great time to overwhelm her with 7 other things. And I can strategically stage how I ask her to take on assignments, being a little more emotionally aware of what that person is experiencing. So anyway, I just wanted to bring that through because that idea of perception, that's exactly, I think, in a nutshell, what I'm really trying to lobby for.
And I think women have to learn how to say no.
Yeah.
There's 3 steps to saying no. Step 1 is open your mouth. Step 2 mm-hmm. is saying, no, that just doesn't work for me. Thank you for thinking of me, but no. Don't say I'll think about it. Don't say I'll try. Don't say I'll get back to you. Say no. And step 3 is closing your mouth. Because when you say no to something, you really are saying yes to something else. And I think that's the concept Christine is just talking about. Mm-hmm. You're saying no to taking on a big project because you want to say yes to a month of IVF. You know, you want to learn how to say no so that you have the ability to say yes.
I hear what you're saying on that. I really do. But I feel like it's still hard because what comes after those three steps is maybe the pushback. Are you sure? How can I convince you? Those are the things that people say to you. Or behind your back, they're saying, well, we're not going to ask her to do that again. We're not going to ask her to do that project or take that on or host this or organize this event. So how do you get to that place?
I think what you want to do is when you say yes 100%. You're going to do your very best job. You've agreed to something. And when you say no, you're being very clear that this is too much for me at this particular time. Ask me next time. I think that people respect you more when you do something and you finish on time and you've put out 100% than when you take on something that you can't possibly do because you have too much else going on and you keep asking for extensions and delays and whatever. So I think that being able to say no allows you to say a very positive yes. I think it makes you more reliable, not less reliable.
I also think, I absolutely agree. I think that over my life as an entrepreneur, and then people say, how did you do it, and you had your three kids and whatever. When I was younger, I said yes lots. And then into my 30s, I said a little less. And then when I turned 40, I was like, no. Like, I recognized what I could and what I couldn't do. So I think it's also about knowing and feeling comfortable about understanding your front yard. I used a lot of my front yard in my early 30s. But as I tailed back and I recognized that, particularly in business, I'm not going to be any use to my business if I'm burnt out. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be able to scale my business for growth if I'm the bottleneck, if I'm taking it all on my shoulders. And maybe people look at me and are like, how can she not do that? Like, she should be, you judge away, watch me grow. So I think that we have to also get to that place where we recognize that saying no is actually going to help us in business.
And one thing I just want to add to this, too, because I love this conversation, I think of it as literally a budget. So when somebody is asking me for something, I'm like, why should I give? Like, I almost think of it as like, if I walk up and I'm like, give me $10. It's like your first response
no.
would be, yeah, no. Or you might ask me, like, what am I going to get in return? Like, you wouldn't just hand it out to anybody that asks. And I think, you know, I can think of one situation just recently where I had a client who wanted me to come in an extra night early. And I kind of have a personal boundary. I want one night away from my kids. That's it. Right now, they're young. I've made a rule that I feel more energized if I spend 4 nights a week at home. One night a week, I can definitely do client work. Well, she wanted me to come in early just kind of for no reason, kind of to hang out and whatever. I was like, I appreciate that, but no. And it was really difficult. Like, she said, can we get on a call real quick? Because I had sent an email back politely declining. And then I got on the call and I'm like doing this, like my palms are sweating. I'm like, I'm sticking to my guns on this, like, because it wasn't value added and I have a priority to something else. So I'm already dedicated somewhere else. And it was just really important to me that I had that extra night at home. She kind of said, so I'm just want to be clear. I'm hearing that you can't come in early before this engagement. And I said, yes, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but I think in the process, you probably also taught her something. You taught her how to do that.
I hope so. And I think as we do that more, we can empower other people. I mean, even the example of, you know, taking a break or to, you know, if you are a leader and you're actually demonstrating how you're managing your own emotional real estate, you demonstrate it and you give permission to everyone around you to do it.
So we're going to open this up to questions on the floor, three of them. I just want to do a really quick question for each of you because this has been a fairly serious conversation. And we are all high-achieving women. But I do want to ask each of you what you do that makes you feel good. Christine.
Oh, first of all, I do exercise. Okay. That is a big one. But I'll just give a simple one. I just realized the other day how much I love listening to music, belting it out at the top of my lungs in my car with the windows up, just because I like everybody else outside that window. I don't want them to hear me. But just like to really, embrace music, it just kind of found me again. And I was like, yes, that
fills my soul.
Vivian.
Well, on serious work days, what I really love to do when I get home is to take a bath and have that quiet time. And I really need that quiet time to decompress. When it's not a serious work day and I'm doing something just for fun, I'm really starting to enjoy golf more and more and more. And the reason I'm enjoying it is because I'm not looking at it as a stress, I'm looking at it as a challenge.
Yeah.
And the person I'm challenging is myself. And so I can play with people who are much better than me. I can play with my brother who told me, you'll never be great, aim for respectable. Which he actually is right. I'll never be great, but I am getting respectable. But that's fun, and it's outside, and it's completely away from the office, and you don't answer your cell phone, and it's a very different activity for me.
So I sing and dance. I sing to my patient's cervixes all the time. I bring to my operating room on my OR days different playlists. I ask patients what they want to wake up to. I will wake them up to the song of their choice. Today I sang hymns to someone's vagina because she wanted me to sing something to her vagina as I transferred an embryo. I was putting an embryo in. And it brings me immense joy. You know what? All my kids are crazy singers, too. We have a karaoke machine in my house. Everybody must sing when they come to my house for anything. So, yeah, it's tremendous.
These are great answers.
That's
this
awesome.
Is awesome. Thank you all. Thank you, each of you. Okay, so I did see a hand. Yes. We can hear you.
She said no.
I'm one of the ones who went through fertility treatment, and I'm so blessed with a daughter. I totally understand the whole manhood thing. I sat there in my office after a miscarriage while somebody announced they were pregnant.
Who wants to take that?
I wish that I could say that I know the answer. I think that the way that I've seen the needle move forward is by being like, we talk about colds, by being like a bad cold and never going away, and just keep harassing the people that can actually make the difference and make it happen. Even after you've been there and you've had your success and you have the ability to have the hindsight to say that was a huge deal for me to be able to say I'm going. I mean, I'm the boss. I can scan myself. I can put a probe in my own vagina and count my follicles. But I didn't have to worry about telling my staff, I'm going to step aside into a room you guys manage. And it's hugely disarming, particularly, as you said, to the people who are low on the totem pole. And the people who are higher up, we have a voice and we have the ability to make that change. And even though people say in a meeting, yeah, this is a great idea, then you go back and you write a proposal and you keep sending in that same proposal and you change it. Remember that proposal I sent you on this date and this date and this date? I'm going to send it again to you because this matters. That's how I have managed to move needles forward. And I think that if we know someone who's higher up in a company who has the ability through human resources or who's at an executive level, that is someone that you know, you say, can I confide in you something? Like, this was really important to me, and it was hugely disarming to me. And, you know, 1 in 6 couples is 15% of the population. It's a huge chunk. We need to address this.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Go ahead.
Okay, hi. I have a question for all three of you. So
I'm quite young. I mean, I'm still in my mid-20s. But then I noticed that a lot of younger women forego, let's say, reproduction, and they go for higher education. So, for example, they go for their master's, they go for their PhDs. So I want to know how you balance your education and also family planning. And what are some of the challenges in your journeys, and how did you overcome those?
Love to get a short answer. Question. Yeah.
I mean, I would just say, in my own experience, I mean, I did an undergrad and master's degree in engineering in my 20s. I didn't really understand just kind of exactly what Marjorie was talking about. I don't think I really understood fertility in its whole, and I also don't think I sought out information. I was kind of like, yeah, you know, Prince Charming's going to show up, it's going to be fabulous, and then it's all going to happen. And so I kind of just deferred and worried about promotions and money and things like that. And so I think, you know, I made the comment that it was, by the time I finally got to a point in life, I was like, okay, I really better start to work with a fertility doctor and pay attention to this. And all I would say is that I wish I had had more education sooner, you know, and understood even like freezing eggs and I wish I had understood those things more. So that would be my words of wisdom, is to understand it so that you're not surprised.
The only thing I would add is that lots of women make different decisions, and lots of women have children when they're in their residency in medicine or when they're doing their PhD and they're at home for the year of writing. People make decisions. There's no best time. The best time is what is the best time for you, and that's different for different people. So aside from the fact that we know fertility goes down with age, and Marjorie, correct me, but around age 32, you start to have decrease in fertility, the decision for an individual person is up to them, their partner, and how they see their life unfolding. I don't think there's a right answer for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I say this to my patients all the time, too. There's never a perfect time. Like, I have people come in and say, I want to have a baby that's born in the year of the monkey and in the month of February. I want a Sagittarius because I have a Capricorn at home. I'm like, ah. But there's never the perfect time to have a baby. The other thing is, like, I think we have to do a better job of educating women about the limitations of their reproductive lifespan, that we can do better. So by the time you've reached the age of 30, you've depleted your ovaries of 90% of their eggs. The good news is the remaining 10% kind of functions well enough until 35 and then drops off pretty well after. By the time you reach the age of 40, you've depleted your ovaries of 97% of their eggs. The bad news is the 3% that remains are pretty much duds. I know, right? Yeah. So we have to do a better job of educating about that. You can free yourself of guilt about freezing your eggs. We couldn't do it really well until 2014 when the experimental ban was lifted, when we were able to do something called vitrification. But now we can talk to women in their 20s at universities, at women's clubs, at sports clubs. We just got to talk about it and say, you should go for your fertility check. There's some blood work that we can do and an ultrasound, and then you can decide if you want to freeze your eggs or not. At least, though, you're empowered to understand that you're making a decision today about what you want to or not want to do. As opposed to your age 33, you come in with your partner, it's not working, and your ovarian reserve is diminished, and you wished you had known 10 years ago. So you can do a fertility check. That's one that you can go see your family doctor or your healthcare provider at your nurse in your university and just say, I just want a capture of where I am now so I can make a decision about what I want to do.